You're listening to a People of Note podcast, as heard on Classic 1027.
Good evening, and welcome to People of Note on Classic 1027. I'm Richard Koch, and this program is broadcast every Sunday from 6 to 8. In it, I talk to someone who is a person of note, and we listen to music of their choice. And I'm very happy to say that my guest tonight is Harold Parkendorf. Good evening.
Good evening, Richard.
And welcome to the program. And I think perhaps to start off with, maybe you could spend just a minute or so telling us who you are and what you've been doing in life, briefly.
Very briefly. I was a newsman, actually, all my life. I edited three different newspapers, one English, two Afrikaans. I was a columnist on two papers, the Sunday Times and Report. I worked on television presenter. I worked on radio. I was a 15-year Sunday evening programmer talking politics. And then in between, I got fired for my political views. It's so long ago, 1986. And then I was self-employed for 20 years as a public speaker and a political analyst. And then a company called Maropa Communications phoned me when I was 66, said, wouldn't I like to come and work for them? I obviously said yes.
And are you still working now?
Well, thereby hangs the tale. At the beginning of last year, they suddenly realized, good heavens, this man is 80. He'd better go on pension. And then I always like to add that Cyril Ramaphosa heard of this and then shut down the country out of sympathy because it was too much for him.
Gosh, so you've been working right up to 80.
Yes, yeah. I still do a bit of radio work, and I still do some translating and some writing, absolutely, yes. Not enough, I think, but some.
But enough to keep you busy.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And when you're not doing radio work or politics or whatever it is, what else do you do? What are your interests outside of newspaper and politics?
My wife mostly, I must say. I'm still interested, very interested in politics and the news. The pattern of my life would be that I get up at 5, take the dog for a walk. When I come back, I drink coffee, and then I watch not on television, all the news sources that I have. And it takes me an hour and a half to 2 hours to keep up to date with what's happening. And then I give my wife coffee, and then the day starts.
Well, and that's been one of the interesting changes that you've seen, I'm sure, in your life. When you say you don't read the paper anymore, you read it online.
Yeah.
You've seen, in your lifetime, you've seen a complete change in how we get our information and our news.
Both in the technical sense and also, and I have to say that first, the way news is handled in the country today, I think we too often are worried about the potholes in the streets and the corruption, and so we must be, obviously. But we must also remind ourselves of what's good about the country. You know, when I was an editor of a paper, we had a lawyer on standby for 24 hours a day. And I remember one conversation we had with him. He said, no, you can't publish that. And we said, we know. That's why we phone you. You must find a way to find how we can publish it. And there were 100 rules and laws which restricted what we could write and what you could read in before 94. And we shouldn't forget that we must have the freest media in the world. You would not be able to be as critical of the president in France as you are in South Africa. We have, and we should be very, very thankful. That's the one real change. And the other one is the one you referred to initially, and that is you used to buy a paper, and papers would have a circulation of 50,000 to 100,000. Now they're down to, 10, 15, 20,000. And it's because you can get the news much faster and much more chewable, if I might put it that way, on your computer and even on your cell phone. You don't even have to have a computer. What it means is that there are far more people computing to get to the news first, and the result is that there are many more mistakes than before. And the so-called social media, very often just a bunch of idiots quite frankly, like Tokyo Sekhwalo now goes around saying the Reserve Bank has trillions of billions of rand, which are about to give away to people. I mean, that's nonsense started by some idiot somewhere in the United States. But a lot of that gets through, and then it's accepted as truth because it is out there. So one has to read differently.
So this is the big fake news story.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, and in the midst of all of this, you obviously enjoy listening to music as well. So your first choice tonight is Dollar Brand or Abdullah Ibrahim. I guess when
That's
you
right.
started out, he was Dollar Brand.
That's right. It comes from a 63 vinyl, yeah.
And it's called Eclipse at Dawn. That was Dollar Brand, as he then was, now Abdullah Ibrahim. Also well in his 80s now, but still playing.
That's right. I saw the other day. It was quite amazing.
Yeah. And that recording also featured Chris McGregor, who is a sort of iconic figure.
Yeah, I think too many people have forgotten about
Definitely.
Him. Definitely. You know, they remember Muketsi, Kippie Muketsi, who was also on there. But Chris McGregor, two wonderful pieces on that particular vinyl, as I say, 63 one. Yeah, and I like them both. And I play them occasionally. Yeah.
And I notice your list of music is pretty eclectic. So you obviously have wide tastes, or you and your wife. Maybe you listen together.
Yeah, no, we do listen together. In fact, one of the better parts of the days when she is up mid-morning and she comes and sits on the stoop and we have a cup of coffee and she plays whatever she feels like playing at that moment. And then later in the afternoon again, yeah.
And off air, you said you've been together for how many years now?
We first went out on the Can You Believe It on the 17th of May, 1957. And then we became firm boyfriend and girlfriend shortly afterwards, and we never looked back, and we've been married for 58 years now. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's an amazing story. 58 years is pretty good going. Well, that's another part of your life, of course. How did you first get into being on newspapers? How did that happen?
My wife, Aletta, actually joined the paper immediately after matric. She just phoned and said, "And do you have a job?" And they asked her to come in, and they interviewed her.
So you were the boss?
No, well, later I was a boss, but then she went to the newspaper first. And then one day, so she worked on the arts pages and so on. And they had to go to a political meeting, and she said, "Please come with me." I went with her, obviously said yes if she asked me. And then when she came back, she said, "She doesn't know how to write this." I said, "That's no problem." And I dictated it to her, and the next morning the news editor called her in and said, "You know, we want to switch you to the political page because this is brilliant stuff," and she had to confess. And then they let me know, "If you're ever out of a job, phone us." And I was working at Newscheck with Robert Hodgins and Otto Krauser and Marty Meiring. At the time, which was a magazine. And then I got retrenched. I mustn't say fired. They just ran out of money. And I phoned the Fatherland, and I said, they said, "Yeah, we remember you. When do you want to start?" And I said, 1st of September. And then afterwards, I became the editor of the Fatherland, and my wife then was my employee.
Yeah. So it was as simple as that.
It was as simple as that.
You were a ghostwriter.
I was a ghostwriter.
That's an amazing story. And you were a sort of will-o'-the-wisp character, which is your next title, Miles Davis. Here it comes. That was Miles Davis with Will-o'-the-Wisp. Obviously another type of jazz that you enjoy too.
Yes, it's almost more intellectual jazz, I would say, than the older versions that one is accustomed to.
Yeah. Did you ever play an instrument yourself? Where did you grow up?
I grew up on a mission station called Botshabelo, which is now the name of a place near Mango and Bloemfontein. Botshabelo was right outside Middelburg in Mpumalanga, Berlin Mission Society. The man who's in the news now, Minele, from Absa Bank, who's resigning at the end of, which must be a few days from now, has been a few days ago. His father comes from there, and lots of very important people were born there. Anyway, I'm not one of those. And then we moved to Johannesburg.
Just stop one moment. So if you were born on a mission station, was your father a minister?
Well, Robert Hodgins, with whom I shared a flat, used to say, "You come from a long line of missionaries," which is actually true. My first one arrived in 1840, and they all then married locally, but they were all Germans.
Was this the Rhenish Mission?
No, it was a Berlin Mission Society. Yeah. And that's where I went. My wife, which is also an interesting story. First day I went to school, I remember it was the 5th of August, 1952. I went to Glasgow, Kensington, and there was this long-legged girl who came around the corner and said to me, "Say something in German." And I said to her in German, "Du bist ein Affe," which means you're a monkey. So years later, I said to her, "That was the last time I said something rude to you." Anyway.
And then you came to Joburg to school.
Yeah. Yeah, that was in Johannesburg. And then I went to Hoërskool Kensington, where she was also. She was in my class from standard 7 to to grade 12. She was always the cleverest girl in the class all those years. Yeah.
And is she still the cleverest girl?
Yeah, she keeps on telling me that she tends to be right.
Well, that's amazing. And we were talking about mission stations. That in itself is an interesting story. And your next choice is called God and Man. This is Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. That was God and Man, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, the choice of Harold Parkendorf, who's my guest in People of Note. Yours is a very well-known name. It's something that's popped up all during my time here in Johannesburg. I arrived here in 1980, and I was soon aware of the name of Harold Parkendorf, although I didn't know exactly who you were, but your face is very familiar to many people. And you said you'd edited 3 different newspapers.
Yeah, I started SABC News. But I wasn't there for long. Much to my father's shock, I resigned after 4 months. He said, "You would have had a good pension. You should have stayed." I went to work for a magazine called Newscheck, which was an attempt at the South African Time magazine, at which Robert Hodgins also worked. And from there, as I said earlier, I went to the fatherland, and I stayed there, and I wrote about politics, and I spent a year in the United States. And when I came back, I was phoned by the then boss, who said, "Can you run a paper?" I said, "Of course I can run a paper." I was 29. I didn't know whether I could, but I wasn't going to tell him I didn't know. And he said, "Well, I want you to fly," which was then to Salisbury, and start a financial paper in what was in Rhodesia. So I said, "Sure, I'll do it." And then I did. And I ran the paper
Scratch. You started it
find the printer, find the business manager, find the journalists, find the officers, everything. After 3 years, he phoned me again and said, "I want you to start an Afrikaans morning paper in Pretoria." I said, "But you must remember, I'm not a member of the National Party with the Boederbond, and I don't intend joining." And I remember him telling me, "I didn't ask you what you belong to. I want to know if you can run a paper." But it did make a difference, actually, because, I mean, you know, in those days, it was very difficult. And then after that, I was there for 7 years. He just phoned me one morning and said, "I want you to run the afternoon paper," which is the biggest paper. I said, "Sure." That was the 1st of November, 1979.
You've got a good memory for dates.
Yeah, Robert Hodgson says I have a head full of useless information.
Now, you've mentioned him several times already. What is your relationship with him? It's the artist you're talking about.
That's right.
But he obviously didn't start as an artist. Or did he? Was he always an artist?
No, he was an artist then. And he taught in the Pretoria, what would now be called the Tech. I met him through Otto Krauser, who was also a former, who's from the famous Bloemfontein Krauser family. And they approached me to work with them they must have found me through my wife, I guess, and from the paper. And so that's where I worked together. Hodgins was on the magazine. And then later we shared a flat for 2 years in Hillbrow. And it was from his flat that I got married, and I borrowed his car to go on my honeymoon.
You didn't borrow his suit to get married?
No.
So, life for you has been a bit of a gamble, because you've accepted, for example, that first job in Salisbury and then Rhodesia.
Yeah.
You just sort of took a chance on it. Well, you obviously were confident that you could do the job.
Yes.
But maybe they took a chance on you, and your next choice of music is The Gambler, Kenny Rogers. It's very appropriate. Here it comes. That was Kenny Rogers with The Gambler, the choice of Harold Parkendorf, who's my guest in People of Note. Has your career always been in, well, apart from Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, has it always been in Joburg?
I spent 7 years.
Yeah,
7 years in Pretoria, and I think I must admit, seeing everybody's admitting to be corrupted. I was corrupted by the Northern Transvaal Rugby Football Unit, become a Blue Bull supporter. They gave me a season ticket and a parking place, so I had to support them.
Yeah, and you're a keen rugby fan.
Oh yes, I played rugby for 10 years with middling ability, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Do you still follow rugby?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Less so than before. You know, the lockdown has changed one's habits, had a direct influence. So you see, there's less to see, and so you watch less, actually.
Yeah. So how have you coped with lockdown?
Well, I had two lockdowns because I was put on pension a week before the lockdown. So suddenly there I was at home, but then I had the thought which gave me some rest, and that is most of the countries in the same position, so it's not unusual. So I think I coped quite well. Fortunately, my wife was there. We grew even closer together, if that's possible.
It is possible. Yeah, and you were talking about rugby, and your next choice is Mannekes Roo with Lorika Rauch, whom you've also has been in your life.
Yes, yeah. I know Lorika Rauch. I knew her better earlier on. We were both younger. We were at Koos du Plessis' house visiting together when they phoned Koos, and she went to the phone and answered, and they told her. And that's why I liked the next song, actually. And this one is, they told her that the song Kinders van die Wind is the theme song of a TV, very popular TV series which was broadcast immediately after. But this song also has a tale to it. In those days, you would just take people from the street to come and work for you. And somebody came and I allowed him to work in the garden, and I played the song, and he came to me and he said, "That man must have had a really tough life." And I was so struck by that he felt for the song that I appointed him as gardener, and he later worked for me at the Fatherland as the copy boy, and I taught him to drive a car, and he became my official driver, and his daughter lived in our house, and is our semi-daughter. So anyway, it's an amazing.
Fantastic. That's an amazing story. And here it comes, Mannekes Roo, and this is sung by Lorika Rauch. That was the famous Mannekes Roo, featuring Lorika Rauch, the choice of Harold Parkendorf, my guest in People of Note. And then you briefly mentioned Koos du Plessis.
Koos was a colleague, and then when I, at the Fatherland, when I first worked there, which was an afternoon Afrikaans paper, and then when I was, after some interruptions, they started the morning paper in Pretoria, I insisted that he come along and be on the sub-editor's desk, and then we became even closer friends than we were before. In fact, you know, it's an interesting side story. Lots of journalists at our house one evening, and then late, and everybody had too much to drink. Koos says, "I'd like to sing your song," and my wife said, "Not another drunken." The reporter thinks he can sing, but he could sing.
Yeah, and here he is, singing Kinders van die Wind.
Now that's Lorika.
Oh, is that Lorika? But it's his song.
It's his song,
yes,
absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was Lorika Rauch singing Kinders van die Wind, the famous song by Koos du Plessis. And that's chosen by Harold Parkendorf, who seems to have known everyone in South Africa, all the singers and performers. And I'm sure you knew David Kramer as well.
When you say no as a journalist, what I hate, I hate about some journalists today, they would say, yes, I knew him. But they may have met him once.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in that sense, I knew him.
Well, it's like everyone says, oh, yes, I know Harold Parkendorf. He was on TV or whatever.
That's right.
On radio.
Yeah, they
all think they know you. Does this happen? Because you're quite distinctive looking. So I'm sure people come up to you and say, hello, and they all think they know you.
That's right. And quite often they earlier on there was more on television, more on radio. That happened more often, but then often people couldn't remember where. They just think, yeah, I know you, but they can't remember from where or what. So you know, yeah. You just smile and answer the questions.
Yeah. Now you mentioned earlier that we live in a world here in South Africa that actually has a very free press. What has been your feeling about how that has changed worldwide in the last, say, 20 years?
Well, unfortunately, one has to say that there has been a rightward shift in politics, and with that, a greater tendency to restrict the freedom of the media.
Worldwide?
Worldwide. I mean, you can call it ethnic politics. I see in America now they call it white nationalism, which is maybe going a bit far, but it also tells you something about what Trumpism was about. And then, and there is more of a feeling of it, not from the Republicans. I mean, I think they go a little overboard by allowing anybody to buy a gun and then say that's taking away your freedom if you can't buy a gun, which, you know, there should be limits to everything in life. So worldwide, you would see that actually there is a movement towards restricting media rather than allowing media to be as free as they are, as we are here in South Africa.
So we're actually bucking the trend a bit.
In a certain sense, yes. I mean, the media is still free in Europe, of course, and in many parts of the world, but not anything like here. I mean, and the other thing we should be careful of together with this, I mean, be thankful for, and let's say it now, is that we live in a constitutional democracy. In the last 10 days, the president of Chad was killed. And what happened? His son takes over. I mean, can you imagine Duduzane Zuma immediately taking over when we get rid of Father Jacob? No, we run a constitutional democracy. You go to court. Remember, P.W. Botha went to court when he was summoned. Nelson Mandela went to court when he was summoned. And if Jacob doesn't, I hope they send him to jail simply because that's how the constitution works.
Yeah. And we should be grateful for that.
We should be. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And, I mean, we often talk about our constitution being a sort of example for the rest of the world. And in many respects, it still is.
No, it is. Absolutely.
And remains. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's come back to your next choice, which is Skipskop of David Kramer.
It's a song about evictions. And these are people, obviously colored, speaking Afrikaans, singing about them being actually evicted from a place called Skipskop, which is on the Cape Coast. And it is below a place where there was a shooting range. So that's partly why they were removed. So it's a moving song. I mean, one can actually get tears in your eyes if you listen to it.
So here it comes, Skipskop by David Kramer. That was David Kramer singing Skipskop. And it's chosen by Harold Parkendorf. Harold, I just want to go back a moment to your origins, because you said your family were from the Berlin Missionary Society.
Yes.
And it's amazing. I've just been reading a book all about the Eastern Cape and the role that missionaries played there, partly as agents of the then government. They were sort of placed in parts of Ciskei and Transkei, really to spy on what was going on, but they were partly missionaries, and some of them were very sympathetic to the people they were working among, but others were definitely not. So missionaries have played a really interesting role in the history of South Africa, in education, in all sorts of ways.
Absolutely, yeah, and developing languages. I like to say, and I'm probably wrong, but it's an interesting thought. There are three distinct Sotho languages in South Africa. If you want to say broadly, Southern, Western, and Northern Sotho, or Sepedi, Tswana, and Southern Sotho. And there are slight differences, because the people who made them written languages and translated the Bible, Southern were the French Catholic missionaries, then there were the Methodists in the old Western Transvaal and now in Northwest, in up in Northern Sotho were in fact Berlin Mission Society missionaries, Germans, and I think that had an impact there. Just as an example of what influence missionaries had. My forefathers also first served in the Eastern Cape. In fact, my one uncle was a missionary Stadtheim in the Eastern Cape, and my grandfather worked near East London, King Williamstown. From there, he moved to Natal, where my father grew up. Different dates. He first went to school when he was 13 because the school was too far. The inspector came by once a year and tested him and said, okay, you're now on the next standard.
And there was quite a strong German community down in the Eastern Cape.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I think after the Crimean War, they brought some...
They brought a German restaurant there,
yeah,
from Hesse, I think it was called. Yeah. In 90, yeah, well, the Crimean War was 61, 63, must have been shortly thereafter,
yeah.
63, 64. That's why you find, and soldiers were given, German soldiers were given property, yeah.
Yeah.
So there you find Berlin and Stadtheim and all kinds of places. That's right.
There are lots of places in that part of the world. And are you very aware of your ancestry? Is it something that you're interested in, the Parkendorf side of your family?
I am not that much, though. I was also in my mother was directly German. My father grew up here and went to university here and then studied theology in Germany, where he met my mother. So I do. My father had seven sisters and two brothers. One was also a missionary. One was a diplomat, and then he was there. He was really played an important role in the Lutheran family as such, and in the SA Council of Churches. And his brother-in-law was also a missionary, so we do actually come from a long line of missionaries.
Yeah.
And I have two brothers and three sisters, and they're all active. My brother Kunta has just been awarded the Academy Prize for a translation from a German book. My other brother was the head of an American publishing house in Germany. My sister was a journalist and a reporter. My other sister is a scientist, and the younger sister was also, in the end, was a sub-owner on a magazine. Yeah. So we're all here. Yeah.
And I did interrupt you earlier when I asked you whether you'd had music in your upbringing. Did you play the piano or the violin?
It's a sad story, actually. My 7-year-old grandson, and we share a house with my youngest daughter, he's now taking piano lessons, and I keep on telling him, 10 minutes is not enough. You must practice more than that. And he says, no, this is easy. Unfortunately, I did have piano lessons, and I much regret that I gave it up for rugby, because it was on the same day that I had played rugby, and my mother wasn't there. She was on the mission station, so I would, have a choice to play rugby and go to piano lessons. And then, oddly enough, when I was 15, in the Lutheran, German Lutheran congregation in Hillbrow, I played the trumpet in the brass band, yeah. But I can't do it anymore.
Yeah. That's amazing. Well, we're talking about missionaries, and there was a Belgian priest in the Congo who got all his congregants to sing together, and they created the Missa Luba.
Which is a really touching piece of work. I don't think anybody can listen to it and not be spellbound.
Yeah, Father Guido Hasen was
his
name.
Yes.
Yeah, and they put out, I think they called themselves the Troubadours of Le Roi Badouin.
That's right, yeah.
And they put out this CD, and here's the Kyrie from the Missa Luba. That was the Kyrie from the Missa Luba. That was a piece put together by Father Guido Hasen in the Congo, what was in the Belgian Congo. Sort of historical recording, that, of him. And it's the choice of Harold Parkendorf. Harold, one of the things you mentioned in passing was that you'd been a Niemann Fellow. What does that mean?
It The name comes from the Nieman family, who donated millions of dollars to Harvard University, and initially only American journalists could apply, and you get a fellowship for a year. And initially you could study whatever you wanted to. Basically, you still can today. My year, which was what the Americans would call a class of 69, I was young for a Nieman, but old for a student. I was 28 when I became a Nieman. And you go there for a year. I took my wife and my first daughter with me, and my second daughter was actually born there. And you could study what you wanted to. Unfortunately, I must say, in my year, that was the first year, they actually demanded some academic work also, which I found unnecessary. But I did for Professor Karl Deutsch. And maybe of passing interest, what I did, I followed through on a book that he'd written and used his approach. And I could prove, and he basically said, if you check what kinds of jobs people have, you can, in a multi-ethnic society, you can see what group will take over when, politically and economically. And so I used that as a basis. Looked at white South Africa only and predicted, according to his, that by 1947 the Afrikaners would take over. Well, it happened a year later. So, but he gave me a B as a mark, which was very good. And then he wrote me a little note saying, "You must now sit down and write down when the blacks will take over in South Africa."
And did you?
I didn't, but I was very interested in the particularly the Rickett Commission and the other commissions, which were set up because it was simply impossible to run the economy with the advancing black South Africans as tradesmen and businessmen and expanding the education system. And thinking back of Professor Deutsch, I thought, well, you know, the way this thing's going, there's something inevitable. And that became, not because of him, I must say, but it came a belief that this came to me when I was in Rhodesia, later Zimbabwe, that it was impossible for 250,000 whites to think that they can run 6 million blacks forever in a day. And I actually proposed a different way of doing it. And if they'd listened to me, they would have had a peaceful transition after 10 years instead of a war in 10 years' time. But anyway, my approach when I came here was very gently and late and much louder voice was, change is inevitable. Better work with it than work against it. And while you're ahead of the game, you might actually have a say in what the outcome will be, which partly worked with the Constitution, but the ANC obviously... I think now many of them regret that we have the constitution we have, but they were very strong on the electoral system we have and on the constitution we have.
So as a journalist in the days when you were in print media, did you feel that you were able to guide people in the way they should go? I mean, was it that strong?
Well, certainly the voice was strong enough that the paper you probably read, The Star, would quote our comments 2-3 times a week because they were so out of line what was generally thought in the day. I like to think that I did. I think what we did was express what people were quietly thinking and unafraid to say out loud, and then suddenly, you know, here it is in print. I tell you a little story. Met many years ago, 10 years ago. I went down to Mossel Bay. I have lots of friends in Mossel Bay, and I'm sure they're listening tonight, and we'll be visiting them soon. A friend of mine, Fred Orban, we used to stay in his holiday home down there. He runs the place. And they came one evening and said, the neighbor wants to come across for a drink. And the neighbor did come across and he said, you know, do you remember in the 17th of Pretoria when you ran the paper Ochenblad? You remember somebody phoned you and said, you must come and take photographs. We're running nude to protest against the university. He said, yeah, well, I was the guy who phoned you. And we ran the photographs, actually. And then he said, and this is the important point, he said, you know, what you wrote in the paper gave us attackers who disagreed with it, politics of the day, a feeling that we're not alone, so thank you, and that's really what I wanted to come and tell you.
Yeah. Well, and also, if you were sort of out of step with what was then mainstream Afrikaans thinking, how did that go down when you were the editor of an Afrikaans newspaper?
Well, I was I had lots of problems. I really did with the within the National Party. There were some members of the cabinet. John Forster was quite. Well, he was very polite, I must say. But he would phone me. First, in 72, he phoned me at home early in the morning just as the sun came up and said, you know, I'm very unhappy with what you've written. Can you come and see me at 3:30? And I'm not very good dealing with authority. I'm not. So I told him, which was very cheeky. I said, Prime Minister, I'm not in the office. If my diary allows it, I'll come and see you at 3:30. But I knew I would go anyway. But I wasn't going to let him think he can tell me what I should do. And then he phoned me, you know, fairly regularly and walked all over me. P.W. Botha and I, he just didn't like me. He once, just before he became Prime Minister, wanted to write a story about his wife because we thought a week ahead that he would win against Connie Muller, and who was our man, actually, but we calculated it, Peter. And he phoned me on a Sunday afternoon in the office, and he was all over me in such a rude manner. So I said to him, you know, it's plain, ordinary journalism that we speak to your wife, and you must never speak to me in that tone of voice and put the phone down. Never spoke to me again, never, except once in Parliament when we had a very nasty article about the far-right group, HNP. He stopped me and said, that was a baie goeie story geweest. But other than that, he never said anything to me, except write letters to the board and complain about me. But yeah. Anyway, that's all gone. Yeah.
Well, we talk about another revolutionary of a different kind now. This is Beethoven, who in musical terms was an incredible disruptor of musical activities. And this is part of his first piano concerto, with Marta Argerich. Let's listen to it, and then you can tell us about your enjoyment of Marta Argerich. Here it comes. That was the Allegro from the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Beethoven, featuring the pianist Marta Argerich, who's a wonderful pianist.
You know, I came across Marta Argerich, my wife, and the then editorial secretary at the Fatherland. I'm sure she doesn't want me to mention the name, but Rina is her first name anyway. Became very good friends, so we'd still visit her. And they always play mostly opera, and I sit on the stoop and drink a glass of wine and read a political book while they play very loud opera music, if I may say. And then she called me and said, come and look at this pianist. And they had an interview with Marta Argerich, and she was playing. And so I just thought she was very attractive, which, of course, has nothing to do with the way she plays the piano. And she is. And I just like the way she plays and the expression she has and the way she obviously enjoys what she's doing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting when you think of how many, let's say, violinists there are now who live on their good looks, I think. I mean, they also play the violin incredibly well. But they are very aware of how they look. And pianists. There's a fantastic pianist from the East called Yuja Wang, who's quite something, too.
That's right. And the other one, we're talking about pianists. I mean, violinists. I really not like the violins so much, but my mother did. And if I may say so quickly, one of the parts of my musical background was when I was in grade 11. I used to go to the old Joburg Symphony Orchestra Thursday evenings, I think, in the Joburg City Hall. Yeah, my mother and I would go by tram and come back in the evening by tram. Yeah, so that was, and she loved the violin, but I didn't. But I call my wife, sometimes I call her Anna Sophie. And I listened to Anna Sophie Mutter last night, and I was quite taken.
Yeah.
She's very attractive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
And plays the violin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously, you like Beethoven because you've also chosen part of the second piano concerto, and this is played by Jan Lisiecki. That was part of the piano concerto number 2 by Beethoven, featuring the pianist Jan Lisiecki, and it's chosen by Harold Parkendorf, who's my guest in People of Note. That's the program you're listening to on Classic 1027. It's broadcast every Sunday from 6 to 8. And just a reminder that during the week, I'm with you every evening on the full works from 7 to 10, except on a Friday or a public holiday when it's from 6 to 9. Now, here we come to part of your rebellious nature, maybe. This is a song by Pete Seeger, "We Shall Overcome." Why have you put that in?
There's also a little story attached to it, partly because, excuse me, when I was at Harvard, we actually attended the live Pete Seeger concert. He was really big at the time. This was 68, 69 people might not remember, but this was the time of the student revolution sweeping through France in particular, but Europe in general, and then in the United States also. And it hit Harvard also. They shut the university down for a while. I don't like being told by people what to do, so I went to lessons, never mind what. And I remember the professor who was there said, there were only three of us out of a class of 30, and he said, there was an African-American, a Southern American, and myself, and he said, you guys are afraid of what will happen to you if you attend the class, you may go. I will teach because I'm paid. And I said, no, I'm staying. It doesn't mean I disagree with the students that are protesting, but they can't tell me what classes I should attend and whatnot. But anyway, that's where we picked up Pete Seeger. And then when this song, We Shall Overcome, which many people want to know if they're younger than I am, and that must be most people, wouldn't know that it was a sign of liberation and freedom, the song itself. And my wife, who was then Aletta, who was working on the Fatherland at the on the arts page, she got a copy of this, not a CD, a vinyl, but with a song on it. And shortly thereafter, the song was banned by the government, so you couldn't hear it. But you could in our flat. We played it, and lots of our friends and fellow journalists came to listen. So that's Pete Seeger taking us back to way back.
Were you living in Hillborough at that time?
We're living in Hillborough at the time, yes.
A sort of seething cauldron of revolution in Hillborough.
That's right, yeah. Well, you know, the Afrikaans group, Fulfray, many of them also performed in Hillborough in those days. You know, the famous one was the Norton's Nima singing under a different name. Set it off, referring to P.W. Boota on television. I mean, so it was different days, yeah.
Here it comes. This is Pete Seeger with We Shall Overcome. That was the famous protest song, We Shall Overcome, sung by Pete Seeger. And Harold Parkendorf, who chose us, we were talking just before we started with this program about how in the old days when things were banned at the SABC, certainly when I worked there, you used to find long-playing records with certain tracks with a deep groove across them, so there was no way you could play them. It's amazing.
Honestly,
and those records are probably still there, actually,
in the library.
Quite amazing.
Sure.
So we've come a long way since those days.
It wouldn't happen today.
No.
No, it's unthinkable that it would happen in the new South Africa.
So what are some of the highlights? I mean, I can imagine some of the highlights that you've had in your career as a journalist, some of the political highlights, some of the noteworthy events that happened. I mean, you've been involved in political reporting and newspapers in a very interesting time in our history.
Well, I think we did a couple of things which were notable, particularly in the beginning in Ochenblatt in 73 and there 72 onwards. It was a milder form of criticism. It was not asking questions about the big homeland system, etc., but it was asking about the humanity of the people in the street. We, for example, ran a little campaign saying, you know, the post office closes at between 1 and 2, and then blacks aren't allowed to sit on the lawn around Paul Kruger. That's completely ridiculous. You know, and that didn't make you very favorable. Popular. But afterwards, what we did, for example, which was unusual, unthinkable in those days, we translated the ANC-based document, the Freedom Charter, into Afrikaans and ran it and without comment, and then got 10 people from different political views to write us comments on it. And it was quite amazing. We also contacting the ANC quite early on in the early 80s. First by telephone. I first started, met my first ANC person in 82 in Hamburg. And I addressed a conference with the New York representative of the ANC. Also spoke in 85. And then, I was early 85 or was it 84? And then we did something on one day which was quite revolutionary. I had gone to see the ANC with that famous meeting with Anglo-American and Tony Bloom and Rally and Tarsus Meiberg and so on. And that was worldwide all over. And I went without telling my bosses. I know some people who were stopped by their bosses, and we were afraid of the security police stopping us. So we flew from our Tambo to Lanseria, took a different plane, and then flew on to Lusaka Airport. But anyway, at the same time, I'd sent a report to Dries van Heerenhof, who's still a friend, and I still see him frequently, sent him up to talk to the ANC, and he had extensive interviews. And simultaneously, we'd sent somebody down to talk to the Soviet ambassador in Lesotho, because after all, PWA was telling us these were the really bad guys. So we thought, let the really bad guys have a chance to have their say. So I think it was on page 4, and there was a full page, my impressions of meeting the ANC, that's Oliver Tambo, Thabo Mbeki, and so on, and Dries van Heerenhof's report on the ANC's view on language, property, the economy, etc., which was, I mean, free publicity for them. And another page further on, there was a full page of an interview with the Russian ambassador saying what his views are. And it was quite interesting, actually. He said, you know, you've got the illusion that we think this is an easy country. We just get the ANC around the country. We don't think that. We think there are lots of political players, the National Party, the old Conservative Party, the Colored Labor Party, the homeland leaders who have background. There's the ANC, there's the PIs. It's not as simple as you think that we think it is. And we published all of that. So on that day, I think that must have been quite a revolutionary day, actually.
Yeah. So it's great to feel that you were around at those times and that you could shift people's image of what the actual situation was.
One must never overestimate what one does in life. Yeah. But the fact that we did it and we did it against the grain of the company, yeah, I worked for, certainly against the grain of the ruling party, who eventually got me fired anyway. By a year later, it took them a long time. If you think the ANC takes a long time, the National Party also took a long time.
No, but that then opened up other possibilities for you as a freelance operator.
Well, that also hangs the tail. Just before I had lunch at the Standard Bank at their behest with Otto Krause. Earlier mentioned Otto Krause and Willem de Klerk, who's the editor of the Transvaal. And I disagreed with him about the politics and the direction and the inevitability and the need for change. And then afterward, when I was fired, on the 19th of May, 1986, shortly thereafter, I had a phone call from a woman I didn't know who said, wouldn't I like to come and talk to her? She wants to publish a monthly political newsletter. And I went to see her, and she said, remember that lunch you had with the guy at Standard Bank? He called me and said, you know, this guy's different. Maybe you should get him, because he's obviously spoken to the ANC. And she then helped me, and we published the monthly newsletter. You know, I only had 4 clients in the beginning, but together they paid me more than I was earning as an editor. And then this is a funny tale, I got a fifth client. It was a security branch who formally said, we want to subscribe to your paper. I went to see Raymond Lowe formally at the round table, and I said, yeah, Ray, what do I do now? I said, well, they're reading it anyway, so let them pay for it. And they did, and about the third edition, they said, would I come and discuss with them the contents of the... So I went to Pretoria to a flat up again. I think it was the 9th floor, there was a beautiful girl opening the door. And I thought, what the hell is this? And she said, no, she wants to talk politics to me. And halfway through, she said, you know, the ANC has a conference. I remember it was at Wits. And wouldn't you go and just check the following things out for us? I said, no, absolutely not. And you're cancelled now anyway. You can't read this publication anymore. I cancelled the subscription. Anyway.
Amazing. Well, now here comes some Beethoven, Zärtliche Liebe, or Ich liebe dich. This is especially for your wife, is it?
Well, it actually is it is for my wife, but it's also from her, for me. She says, I have to say to you that it's sung in a language she loves. She was a pen pal of my German grandfather, can you believe it, when she was 19. He was in Germany, she was in Joburg, and she wrote in German letters. It's a favorite, the composer, and she absolutely adores the singer, and the song is for me.
So it's Elina Garanča singing, and the piece is Zärtliche Liebe by Beethoven. That was the singer Elina Garanča performing Zärtliche Liebe, Ich liebe dich, by Beethoven, the choice of Harold Parkendorf, who's my guest in People of Note. And so we're just about at the end of this interview now, and I just want to say thank you for being on People of Note on Classic 1027.
It was an absolute pleasure talking to you.
I hope that Classic 1027 is one of the stations you might listen to occasionally.
I do, but I have to tell you, and even this is, as somebody famously at SABC, on your air, I understand the need, the market dictates, but it's not as classic as it was in the beginning. It has lighter music also, which meant that I could include some lighter music too.
Yeah, which is good. And your final choice is actually for me, because Bach is my favorite, and you've chosen a piano version of the Toccata, Adagio, and Fugue with Evgeny Kissin. Now, I don't know why you particularly chose the piano version.
Well, it's first of all, I had difficulty finding the organ version. I mean, so I came across Evgeny Kissin, and I thought, that's fine. It sounds thinner, but let me just tell a little story about that. When I shared that flat with Robert Hodgins, much against my mother's will, I must say, and I got married, and then I went to Harvard and went on to Zimbabwe, and I remember long, and it was on the top of the second page. It was quite a Dear Makar letter from Rob to Aletta and myself. And at the top it said, you know, it's Sunday evening. What was one do on Sunday evening? You drink a glass of red wine and you listen to Beethoven and Bach. And I thought, well, that's it.
There we are. So we've had Beethoven and Bach. This is the Adagio from the Toccata, Adagio, and Fugue, played on the piano rather than the organ by Evgeny Kissin. That was Evgeny Kissin performing the Adagio from the Toccata, Adagio, and Fugue. It's in an arrangement for piano. It's by the famous Johann Sebastian Bach. And that's the final choice of Harold Parkendorf, who's been my guest. Thank you again for being on the program, and thank you at home for listening. I'll be back, remember, with full works each weekday evening, so I hope to have your company then. And from all of us here at Classic 1027, we wish you a very good night.